It's Thursday, November 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Chinese journalist Gao Yu is released from prison for medical reasons.
In our opinion, she shouldn't have been imprisoned or detained in the first place because she's doing the job of a journalist. And China's state secret legislation is very vague.
The United Nations warns that air pollution in the Asia-Pacific region has a rising cost. And we hear about the American dancer and choreographer, Twyla Tharp. It's all ahead. Chinese authorities have released on medical leave a 71-year-old journalist in prison on charges of leaking state secrets. State media announced the news Thursday, just hours after a court reduced the sentence for Gao Yu from 7 years to five. After that ruling, her lawyers announced they were seeking medical leave for their client, who suffers from heart trouble. I'm joined now by Maya Wong, who's a researcher for Human Rights Watch in Hong Kong. Maya, what is known about, this is a developing case, but what is known about Gao Yu at this moment?
She's a veteran journalist who has been working in China for many years. She started working in the state press and later was working for a liberal magazine that was quite instrumental during the 1989 pro-democracy protests. And for all her criticism of the government, she's been jailed three times. So this is her third time in prison, and she's 71 years old. And for this time, she's been imprisoned for allegedly leaking an internal party document that is about instructing lower-level officials to tighten civil liberties across China.
Yeah, I believe that's known as document number 9.
Yeah, it's called document number 9, and is in our opinion, she shouldn't have been imprisoned or detained in the first place because she's doing the job of a journalist, and China's state secret legislation is very vague, and it allows any document to be considered a state secret document as long as the government says it is, and there's no kind of effective recourse to challenge that. So even any document that has to do with kind of public interest, I still consider that. And in this case, Gao Yu has been detained for allegedly releasing that document. So she has been in very poor health, so we are happy that she has been released on medical parole.
Okay, now apparently originally the authorities reduced her sentence from, I think, 7 years to five, but then apparently they announced she is being released. Will she be under some sort of like house arrest?
It's a little bit unclear. I mean, this is medical parole is a legal procedure under Chinese law for people who are for detainees who are very ill. But given kind of the previous record of how activists and dissidents are treated after they are released from prison, some examples are like lawyer Gao Zhisheng or the barefoot lawyer Chen Guangcheng, it's likely that she would be under some form of house arrest and surveillance and monitoring.
But apparently this is fairly rare that authorities, that officials would do this, you know, that they would give her, a release because of her health situation.
Yes, it's correct. I mean, in the past, in previous administrations in the government of China, there were more of these cases. But under Xi, under a very severe crackdown on civil society, kind of leaves and reductions of sentences of activists is generally very, very rare. So this is definitely rare good news in a very relentlessly grim period for Chinese activists. And it shows that pressure from other governments work. And we hope that means that other governments will put further pressure on many other cases of prominent activists and other activists currently being held in China.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That's Maya Wong of Human Rights Watch in Hong Kong. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Well, looking at social media today, there's a reaction to the release of journalist Gao Yu by Chinese authorities. William Ni, China researcher at Amnesty International, tweets, "Good news, Gao Yu released for medical reasons and will serve sentence outside of prison." Didi Tang of the Associated Press tweets, "Gao Yu is released to serve her time outside jail." The United States included Gao Yu in a social media campaign called Free the 20, highlighting the cases of 20 female political prisoners from 13 countries. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists in California have found that the largest moon of Mars, Phobos, is slowly inching closer toward the red planet. They predict that once the gravity of Mars finally overpowers the moon in about 20 to 40 million years, the moon will probably be shredded to bits. The scientists from the University of California, Berkeley, explain that since Phobos is in such fragile condition, the closer it gets to the red planet, it will begin to break up instead of crashing into Mars intact. While some of the moon's largest remains will probably smash into Mars, most of the smaller bits and pieces are expected to spread out above the planet, where they will circle it like the rings of Saturn. After millions of years of orbiting the planet, the researchers say that Phobos remains will eventually fall to the surface of Mars, much like our meteor showers here on Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll take a look at the career of Twyla Tharp. As French President François Hollande continued his global diplomatic effort to forge an alliance against the Islamic State group with a stop in Moscow Thursday, tensions between Russia and Turkey over the downing of a Russian warplane remain high. Russia has announced increased inspections of Turkish food imports. Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told a news conference in Moscow Russia does not intend to wage war on Turkey, but said Tuesday's downing of the Su-24 bomber by Turkish jet fighters, an incident that took the life of a Russian crewman, looked very much like a pre-planned operation and promised a reassessment of bilateral relations. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called it a purely defensive move, not designed to escalate matters. Moscow has announced plans to deploy an air defense missile system in northwestern Syria to protect its aircraft. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who was posted to Ankara and is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says it was a calculated move by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's probably the least Putin could do, and it represents not a good thing because it will threaten the Israelis, and the thing has a range of 155 miles, potentially also some of our aircraft if they were foolish enough to shoot at us. It's essentially a defensive step, and it's better than bombing a Turkish airfield.
Was that a possibility in your view?
Here's the thing. We have learned since 1999, with Putin's having a major role in Russian battalions showing up in Kosovo after we had defeated the Serbs, that you don't underestimate Putin and his ability to surprise you. And he's a guy who basically takes risks all the time with the assumption, which he has been proven correct again and again and again, with all of the NATO allies and all kinds of overflights of NATO territory, all sorts of provocations, his submarines in national waters, what he's done in Crimea, what he did in the Ukraine. And he's done this repeatedly with the Turks, particularly back in October. He not only penetrated Turkish airspace, but they locked on Turkish aircraft with their fire control radars. And they've been warned repeatedly by the Turks on this, and the Turks also warned them about bombing the Turkmen right along the border. I think he was surprised by what Erdogan did.
Is this going to suck the NATO alliance and Russia into some sort of confrontation?
I don't see how. If Russia takes military action against Turkey, yes, obviously, but Russia hasn't taken military action against Turkey. And NATO already has surface-to-air missiles in southern Turkey. We just withdrew them, but they can go back in. We have a relatively large contingent of aircraft at Incirlik and elsewhere in southern Turkey. And the Turks have a fleet of 200-plus F-16s. To put that in context, Putin has, well, he had 30 aircraft, roughly. Now he's got 29.
That's Ambassador James Jeffrey. He says he spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Ambassador Jeffrey says Russia has little leverage with Turkey given its membership in NATO and control of key shipping lanes Russia uses. However, the University of San Francisco's Stephen Zunes tells VOA's Victor Beatty he's surprised at Turkey's military action.
This was a surprisingly provocative act by Turkey, given their economic dependence on Russia. I was actually on the Turkish coast just a few months ago, and I was struck by the large number of Russian tourists, including Russian business people. And so they will probably be feeling a hit as a result of this. I mean, when an airplane crosses international boundary into a country's airspace, they do have the legal right to shoot them down. But given that this infraction lasted only 17 seconds and they were not bombing within Turkey, it does raise questions about why they would go to the extent of defending their airspace by actually shooting down a plane.
Neither side is backing down. Turkey's President Erdogan remained rather defiant that Turkey did the right thing.
There's a lot more at stake here than simply an infraction across a border. The bombing raids in that part of Syria near the Turkish border have not been directed at ISIS. ISIS does not have any presence in that province. They have been fighting fighters from al-Nusra, which Turkey has been quietly supporting. But there are also, and this is an important piece, Turkmen militia. These are an ethnic minority that are closely related to Turks themselves, who have been getting quite a bit of support from the Erdogan government. Indeed, these were probably the targets of the Russian airstrikes, which is why Turkey may have felt a particular desire to take down that Russian plane.
And Stephen Zun says the longer these tensions between two major players in Syria's future persist, the longer the Islamic State will continue to operate inside both Syria and Iraq, making a political solution to the Syrian conflict even more difficult and the suffering of the Syrian people even more severe. The United Nations says the rising level of airborne pollution in Asia is extracting greater social and economic costs, leading to millions of people dying prematurely each year. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok.
Globally, some 7 million people a year die prematurely due to indoor and outdoor pollution, with about 70% of those deaths in the Asia-Pacific. From forest fires with their smoky haze over Southeast Asia to China's smoke-filled megacities to rural homes in South Asia choked by inefficient stoves, scientists say in Asia there are rising health and social costs from airborne particle pollution. Kaveh Zahidi, the UN's Environment Programme Regional Representative for Asia and the Pacific, says the costs from air pollution are rising for millions across the region, with hundreds of cities facing pollution levels exceeding World Health Organization safety standards.
Air pollution, air quality has to be one of the top priorities. We know that well over 200 cities within Asia exceed WHO guidelines on PM 2.5 emissions. Now, with millions of people living in them, exceed WHO guidelines on air pollution and PM 2.5, which is directly linked with basically chronic health problems.
The UNEP this week brought together more than 120 scientists, government officials, academics, and a range of international organizations, aiming them to develop a joint program to tackle air pollution in the region. Scientists warn that without significant steps, the number of premature deaths from airborne pollution will double by 2050. In South Asia, from Bangladesh to India and Pakistan, the toll to human life has been directly linked to people using stoves that burn solid cooking fuels like wood or dung. Kalpana Balakrishnan, director of the WHO's Collaborating Center for Occupational and Environmental Health, says this indoor pollution is a major contributor to health problems that compares to the pollution faced by urban communities with traffic-borne smog.
The burdens are high, and the nature of the burdens on health. So it's not just a chronic respiratory problem, but it's also a cardiovascular problem. And it is not just a young children's and women's problem, but, across all age groups and men and women, everybody's impacted. Makes it the topmost public health environmental concern.
Balakrishnan says in India alone, some 3.5 million deaths a year are attributable to household air pollution. But, she adds, India's economic growth and rising incomes has led to more families to seek alternatives to solid fuels, such as liquid petroleum gas. Atmospheric brown clouds over megacities from Bangkok, Japan, China and throughout India also extract serious costs to communities, says Teru Yuki Nakajima, director of Japan's Aerospace Exploration Agency and chair of the UNEP's Asian team focused on the smog.
I think reducing the Asian air pollution is very important. That is, the vulnerable group is like the small children and the people in poverty situation, and also the aged people in Asia, like China, Japan. So society is getting old with the more and more aged people. They have some asthma problem and brain stroke, and the particle matters really affect to those people who has this kind of a symptom disease.
Amid the smoke haze crisis in Singapore this year, the government took legal action against at least six Indonesian companies. At the same time, China is reported to be increasing investment to curb severe pollution in major cities, both the capital and regionally. But UN scientists say more must be done than merely punishing polluters. They say the challenge lies in ensuring there is the political will to enforce existing environmental laws and cooperate on cross-border problems such as smoke haze and other atmospheric pollution. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Choreographer and dancer Twyla Tharp is an American icon, this year celebrating her 50th anniversary in the world of dance. She's won a Tony, two Emmys, and been a Kennedy Center honoree. For her golden anniversary this year, Tharp's been taking a pair of new works on a 17-city tour. Bill Zeeble reports from Dallas, Texas, where the tour began.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
In April of 1965, Twyla Tharp, with two colleagues, danced her first work using Petula Clark's popular song, Downtown.
Just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose?
She told the Dallas audience that Tank Dive premiered in New York's Hunter College and lasted all of about 4.5 minutes.
Because I figured that's all I knew about a beginning and a middle and an end, and I could get it into that period of time. So if you were late, you kind of missed the whole thing. But that was okay, because I think 14 people came. And that's okay, too.
Because she knew that she could do it. She's since created hundreds of dances over 5 decades, presenting them on the dance stage, Broadway theaters, for television and film. On this anniversary tour, she presents not one, but two premieres. Tharp is 74. She does not believe in slowing down.
The point of work is, to me, doing more work. There's always time for the past, and I value the past. Not only my past, but others' past. But the future's got lots of room for the past. The present has only now.
And for now, Tharp says it's time for the world as it ought to be, and for the world as it is, at least according to her. to Bach's well-tempered clavier, Tharp pays tribute to dance giants she learned from, Merce Cunningham, Martha Graham, Jerome Robbins, George Balanchine. Tharp's first work, Preludes and Fugues, presents a world of equality, justice, balance.
People have an overview of tolerance, and that diversity does not separate. It is possible to congregate as a diverse lot. That would be the world as it ought to be. The world as it is had best be approached with humor.
And so the other work, Yowzy, is dance to jazz, with funny interactions between couples and slapstick moves inspired by Tharp's beloved silent film comedies. As she helped pioneer the use of pop, rock, and jazz in serious dance, Tharp also blended modern and classical ballet moves in her work. That used to shock the dance world, but no more. Dancer John Celia, who matured with the Classical American Ballet Theater, joined Tharp 16 years ago.
I love being a ballet dancer, but sometimes I disagree with how marginalized it is. People have a certain idea of it, and if it goes out of the boundaries, they reject it.
Celia embraced it, welcoming the challenge of dancing in Tharp's company and learning to be more creative than he'd been allowed at ABT. Combining dance styles and musical genres opened up the art form, says Lily Weiss. The longtime professional dancer is the artistic director at Dallas's Booker T. Washington High School. It's consistently among the nation's best art schools. She says Tharp, the pioneer, is the role model for pushing boundaries.
That's why she was so accessible and so successful, I think, is she not only spoke to the patron who wants to be moved by art, but she spoke to a patron that enjoyed watching accessible dance.
Tharp is also just really funny. She was a pre-med student before deciding she could learn more about the human body through dance. Other than honorary degrees, she doesn't have a PhD or medical degree, but she says she's a doctor of sorts and pounds the microphone for emphasis.
I do consider myself a doctor, and one of my missions is that when an audience leaves our theater, that audience needs to feel better leaving than it did coming in. And if it doesn't, we haven't done our job.
Twyla Tharp's anniversary prescription to audiences has been these two new works and two past pieces on a triumphant national tour. For VOA News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us and have a very happy Thanksgiving.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The first Thursday in November is a national day of Thanksgiving in the United States. The tradition is a very old one, dating to the arrival of the first English settlers in North America in the 17th century, who, after their first successful harvest, paused to celebrate their bounty and give thanks for surviving their first terrible winter in what was then a wilderness. Falling in the autumn, Thanksgiving has much in common with harvest holidays in other nations and cultures, such as Vietnam's Chung Tu celebration and Hamoo, the annual Yam Festival in Ghana. Still, with its turkey dinners, family gatherings, football games, and parades, there's something about the day that is distinctively American. Together with July 4th, when the United States marks its independence from Great Britain, it's a truly national holiday that includes all citizens in a common purpose, regardless of religious, political, or ethnic persuasion. It is also a time for people to look back at the year, take stock, and think about the future. With our nation dealing with crises in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and West Africa, the looming uncertainties likely will be on many minds today. President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the first official Thanksgiving amid similar serious circumstances, the American Civil War. But like their colonial ancestors, Americans are essentially an optimistic people. Surrounded by friends and family, today as in the past, they will enter into the spirit of the day, giving thanks for life's blessings and the promise of the future living in a free land.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.